Live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, downtown in the heart of the Byward Market. Welcome to Sunday Night. Here's Rabbi Balka.
And you know, today is Mother's Day, but I just found out and I'm really terribly upset to hear of the passing of Gail Madeley, our dear colleague Steve Madeley's dear wife. What a wonderful marriage they had and how devoted they were to each other. And our hearts go out to Steve and the entire family. And we send our profound condolences to the entire Madeley family and, of course, the CFRA family, for whom Steve is a cherished member. It's hard to get out from the funk when something like this happens, but we are delighted to have with us tonight in studio one of our perennial guests, someone that's no stranger to CFRA. He's probably ubiquitous is a good word to say to describe him, Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we have him usually once every 3 months, and delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. So I have a question for you. Is Eric Carlson a freak?
A freak? No.
The way he healed, and is this something medical? Is it going to be in the medical books?
No, I don't think so. One of the issues is that we are making assumptions about the type of injury he had and how severe it was.
Because you hear Achilles, you say, oy vey, he's gone for the year.
But we don't know. I mean, we're not privy to that medical information. So all we can say is that there are always distributions of how people respond and heal, but there are also physical laws, for lack of a better term, that dictate how quickly a particular type of tissue heals. Right. So tendons tend to heal slowly, and if he recovered at this rate, means that the injury that was described may or may not have been as severe as initially reported or as we surmised.
As we thunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, it's not a matter of, he's also young, and younger people heal more quickly than older folks. So, no, I don't think he's any specific freak or anything like that.
Now, take a look at it now. The sedative is sort of banged up through the entire year, and by rights, should not have made the playoffs, but they did.
Yeah.
And now they're sort of in an interesting position where some of the people that got banged up that are now healed,
that may be able to come back as well.
Well, I don't know about Spetzer, but they basically do not have the war scars of having played through and whatever truncated season.
Yeah.
So they got guys like Cowan and McCulloch. They didn't, and Carlson. So they're in pretty good shape.
They seem to be. I mean, we'll see how they do. I follow hockey a bit. I mean, I had.
You got to be a Sens fan, though.
Oh, I'm a Canadiens fan.
Oh,
but that's.
But okay. I say, in fairness to them, they got the injuries the wrong time.
Yeah, they had the. But even so, even though a Canadiens fan, which goes back just because they were my team during my childhood, so it's hard to just let that go. But overall, in terms of following hockey, I got other things to do. I got other things that
really,
I
can't believe it.
Yeah, I'm not. I've become so disenfranchised with the strikes and with the
shenanigans that go on. It's funny how people forget.
In as much as that people are excited about the playoffs, you know, I got other things in my life that I pay attention to, that I need to pay attention to, that. Hockey as well. It's sort of, okay, what was the score? Okay, now let's move on. But I don't live and die by it. It doesn't make my day or break my day. If the team loses, I don't fret about it. I don't worry.
You won't need therapy in case the Senators perchance.
No, and good luck to the Senators. People get a lot of enjoyment out of following hockey, and that's fine. I'm not being critical of those that follow it. It's just for myself. It's just out there, but it's not something that I'll pay that much attention to.
I have to give people the numbers because I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to be in touch with you.
Sure.
Here's the doctor is making another house call. This is a late night house call. 613-521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility. A free call. 800-580-2372. Our toll free number. RBULKA at CFRA.ca in case you want to just leave an email message. But I don't know why you'd want to do that if you could talk to the doctor directly and not through a medium such as me. I'm trying to think of the interesting things that have happened. You follow things very carefully. And I think we got into this last time at the end, but this time maybe I'll try to do it at the beginning.
Sure.
What are in your mind some of the more exciting things that have happened in medicine? Absent the media hype, you know, that you say the cancer cure is around the corner, all that stuff, which I think is very irresponsible. What's been happening? What I saw yesterday on TV, which was about a new implant for hearing, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that's along the lines of what's becoming more prevalent as we see the advent of more miniaturization, more computing power in smaller and more tinier spaces. The devices and the technologies developed are advancing at such a pace that we don't even know the potential yet. It's as if we were starting at the beginning of the computer age.
Right.
I go back to 1979. I bought my first computer at that time. It was an Apple II computer with 16 kilobytes of RAM, no hard drive, and you had to load the programs on with a cassette tape. And, you know, you wonder, and so if someone were to ask, you know, what do you think is going to happen over the next 40 years or so? And it's been, you couldn't even imagine, right?
Right.
And now it's nothing short of magic. You know, I got a new phone the other day, right? This phone here. And literally, if you were to give this to somebody 40 years ago, they would think this is a piece of magic with everything that is encompassed in this, that in a smartphone, you have enough technology and enough computing power that, you know, would be unimaginable to when they first had the ENIAC computers and such. So when you look at the medical technologies, there are technologies, for example, that now that they've used successfully with regards to weight loss. And how do they do that? This is a device that is inserted through a little scope into the abdomen, and it, you know how a blood pressure cuff fits around your arm?
Right.
Well, this has a little cuff that fits around a nerve called the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is a...
Not the thing from stop you from gambling.
No. It's the 10th cranial nerve. It's the longest nerve in your body that runs from your brainstem all the way down to the distal two-thirds of your large intestine. And what they've been able to do is not only understand how that nerve communicates hunger and appetite to the brain, but they've decoded the signals. And in so doing, this little cuff picks up those signals, the computer chip analyzes those signals, and then changes them so that the signal that goes up to your brain suppresses your appetite.
Son of a gun.
And it's completely reversible. That is, you're now not cutting any tissue, you're not changing the plumbing, as it were. No, it's inserted surgically into the abdomen, and it just monitors that particular, it's like a wiretap on that nerve. And again, think of this.
So how does it go in? It actually it,
just
is
like when you do it, you use a scope and you go into the abdomen to do this endoscopic surgeries.
Right.
They just go in with this and they with a scope and they find the nerve, and so minimally invasive surgery.
And they attach it to the nerve.
They just attach it to the nerve, a cuff around the nerve, so you're not even touching the nerve. It's just sensing the signals and then translating it, and then sending those signals up to the brain in a changed way so that you end up not having to eat as much.
Right, and who does the control? The patient does their own control?
No, this is the chip is programmed. It's a little chip that sits around this cuff, little brain sitting on
this
cuff.
But you say it can change, right?
You can program it, sure.
You can program it to say, I don't want to eat for 7 days or something.
Well, it actually just reduces, you still get hungry, but it sends a signal to tell you that you're full earlier, right? So really, really interesting. So, I mean, these kind of technologies that we're seeing are just starting. You know, you also had, I covered a story with Mark Sutcliffe on Friday.
So let's hold that. We'll come back. We'll take a break. We'll find out the story that the good doctor covered with Mark Sutcliffe. 613-521-8255, star 580, availability 800-580-2372. and RBULK at CFA.com. And the Leafs won. There'll be a game seven. We'll be back.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bolka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Well, today is Mother's Day, so we're going to begin each segment with a quote about mothers. Try this one from Taniva Jordan. A mother is a person who, seeing there are only four pieces of pie for five people, promptly announces that she never did care for pie. Okay. And so you were telling us about Mark Sutcliffe on Friday.
Yeah. There's you know, you're talking about the advances and what it takes to create those advances. I think when we hear a story, part of the wonder of the story is to think of what led up to the creation of this particular invention, because it's not something that just happens. Inventions right. happen based on the work of everybody else. And so this particular story is about the development of these, they're called nanoparticles, literally 1/1,000,000th of a meter in diameter. So very tiny. And they're charged. They have positive and negative charges. And when you create these particles, they stick together because positive and negative attract. These particles contain in them, in the center, is insulin. And then around that, you have a layer of what's called dextran. And dextran is another type of sugar. Mm-hmm. And that acts as the packaging around the insulin to keep it in one spot. And then around the dextran, you've got an enzyme that just sits around the dextran. Now, this enzyme is designed to break down the dextran, except it doesn't do that until it's exposed to elevated levels of blood sugar. So what they did, and this they did in mice that were bred to be diabetic, they injected this compound, these nanoparticles, into the mice. And what happens is these mice had elevated levels of blood sugar that caused, through this cascading reaction, the enzyme got activated, the dextran broke down, and insulin was released. And it maintained normal blood sugars for about 10 days without having to give another dose of this. So it literally acted as a means of monitoring blood sugar automatically and keeping the sugars down. So if you adapt this technology for human use, and you think of the difficulties, for example, in the elderly who have to, you know, if they're giving themselves insulin shots, they forget. The dosing has to change. They likely will refine this.
Yeah, and Fontaine will become.
But again, think of the technology to create something that small, to understand how the chemical processes work. And to use the enzyme that the blood sugar would trigger to break down the dextran that led to the insulin release. It's just fascinating stuff.
That's great. Yeah. And by the way, you remember when the computer first came out,
yeah.
one predictor said it'll never fly because
right.
the first one was so big and
it was like a
piano.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Well, we have John in Gloucester. John, welcome.
Well, welcome.
How are you?
I'm good tonight. How are you guys?
Good tonight.
Fine, thanks.
Means you weren't good yesterday or you're not going to be good tomorrow? Which one is that?
Well, I think I'll be battling, batting three in a row. I think it's been a good weekend.
That's good. Good, good. So you had a comment about tendons?
Yes. Since you started off that topic, I myself did tear a bicep tendon about 5 weeks ago. Playing volleyball, and I've had some, you know, chronic problems with that shoulder over the last couple of years. And besides the option for surgery, is there any way that a tendon, let's say the short tendon on the upper bicep, would it ever perhaps like regrow or heal itself, or how would the other tendon compensate for that loss?
Oh, it's a good question. The short answer to the whether it will grow back or grow back is no. And the reason is that when a tendon ruptures, the muscle that it attaches to contracts. So it literally pulls the tendon even farther away from where it ruptured. And so it's too far distant from the bone, or what we call the insertion site of that particular muscle, mm-hmm. for that tendon to reattach itself. And that's where the muscle balls up, or you notice that there's a lump in the muscle that wasn't there before.
And there is, yes.
Yeah. And so that, unfortunately, will not regrow or repair itself. That's that's the unfortunate consequence of the tendon rupture. That being said, the other portion of the muscle, being a biceps, means there's two heads to the muscle, or that particular part of the muscle will compensate and get stronger as you use the arm. The tendon itself is, again, you have to be careful that the activities being done don't overwhelm that tendon and rupture that. But again, less likely to happen if you take care of using the arm and minimize sudden motions or sudden generations of force in the arm, which sometimes snap the tendons. So you will notice that the portion of the muscle that is functional will get larger and stronger as a means of compensating.
I see. And would ever down the road, could that tendon that you have not had surgery on, could it ever be reworked, let's say 5-6 months or a year down the road?
Usually the longer one waits to repair it, and in some cases they don't, because surgeons will, usually they have certain criteria to repair a tendon. And because sometimes the surgeries are, and the repair is more difficult and causes more problems than leaving things alone. So for example, somebody who is an athlete or a high-performance athlete. I think the Canadians' captain was a Gianta, I think
Gianta,
it is,
yeah.
Who had a ruptured biceps tendon, had surgery done to repair it. People who have occupations that depend on using their arms, where they're lifting or they really have to have that full power, will sometimes get the repairs done. So those are some of the criteria. For many other people, and also it's more so for people that are younger, because it's more difficult to repair things when people are older. The rehabilitation process can be longer, healing times can be longer. So the issue of repairing it, especially down the line, the longer one waits to repair it, if indeed it was fulfilled the criteria for repair, the more difficult it is, because the muscle contracts, and that ball that you feel in the remaining muscle can scar up and becomes that much more difficult to pull and stretch if you were to try and reattach the tendon. So that's the issue with regards to repair. Usually they try to repair the muscle early on, repair the tendon early on, because the muscle still has some elasticity. But once it remains contracted for too long, it's very difficult to stretch that muscle out again.
So too long is like less than 2 months or less than 3 months?
Too long is usually about 3 to 6 months, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I wish you well, John.
Well, thanks very much for your answer.
Good luck to you.
Okay.
So we have Robert in Canada on deck. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Okay, my adopted advisor, Dr. Dworkin here.
Yes. Your adopted advisor?
Spiritually, Rabbi Bulkin, here we go.
Go ahead.
I trust you guys. With respect to nanotechnologies, and Dr. Dworkin, I'm looking at superbugs.
Yes.
I found that all we need to do is mix in nanotitanium in with paint. Okay, And that, when you turn on fluorescent lights, all the superbugs we're talking about will rip the membrane of the cell, okay, if they even move slightly on that nanotitanium that's mixed in with the paint. And all you need to do is turn on fluorescent lights to have it activated more so. I don't know the process, but I would have to look into that further.
I'm curious, where'd you hear this? This is pretty neat.
Well, I read it on the net.
Okay.
I'm looking at metrology as it relates to, nanotechnologies in mechanical to solve the superbug problem. Like people from mechanical engineering don't tolerate not being able to solve problems.
Right.
So when you want to get something done, you move to that area and you find all these guys that are already there. Anyways, I have a meeting with Dr. Kitts, Dr. Roth, and the head of housekeeping for the Ottawa Hospital on Thursday, and I'm going to propose having my own lab for medical metrology at the Ottawa Hospital. Now, do you have such a lab?
I you know what? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't.
Well, I highly doubt it.
I don't think so.
And nanotechnology, as you say, is becoming mind-blowing in the area, right?
It's pretty amazing when you think of the applications. And you raise a very good point also about mechanical engineering. It's all kinds of disciplines that you wouldn't think would be contributing really
exactly.
Give a different perspective on how to approach the problems.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Robert, you know what you can do? You can bring the podcast of this program to your interview.
Well, I'm wondering how to dress for. I want your advice. I want to know how to dress for the interview. And Rabbi, please, spiritually, I want to put my best foot forward.
Well, usually, again, for that meeting, I would dress with, you know, again, if you have a suit, tie.
Suit and tie.
Kind of
right.
Look really professional. Come with the evidence that you have, but and also get multiple references for the evidence. Try and contact the people that actually produce this to see if they can send you some of the details.
Well, I can't pull all that off in 4 days. I'm on dial-up.
But see if you have any other places which have something like this so that they realize that they're not.
But you can also go to the Ottawa Public Library because they have high-speed stuff, and you can get all the stuff done that way,
Robert,
too.
You hear the music means we have to break for the 10:30
Thanks,
news.
Guys.
But good luck to you. Call in next week and let me know how you did.
Okay.
Take care. News coming up at 10 and a half.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bolka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
So contemplate this quote from James Joyce. It's a direct quote, folks, so don't hit me for it. Whatever else is unsure in this stinking dunghill of a world, a mother's love is not. Our numbers, folks, 613-521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, a free call, 800-580-2372, our toll-free number, rbulk@cfra.com. Chucky has a question for you, good doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, he says, hello, healthy gentleman. Are there infections which do not necessarily show up as an elevated white blood cell count? Are there tests other than sedimentation tests and white blood cell count which indicate infection?
There are situations when white blood cell counts do not go up when someone has an infection. The most common situation is usually if someone is already immunocompromised, if they are taking medications that suppress their immune response. So people, for example, that are taking medications to treat rheumatoid arthritis, other inflammatory conditions in the body, what we call rheumatologic diseases, muscle wasting diseases, psoriasis, I mean, a whole host of conditions. So sometimes when someone gets an infection, if they're taking those medications, they may not necessarily get the same white blood cell counts. And white blood cells normally increase in response to an infection
right.
because they're designed to protect the body and destroy that infection. So people that are on medications to reduce their immune response, people that have, for example, HIV or other immunodeficiency diseases may not also mount the same kind of response. Sometimes what happens paradoxically is that severe infections, so fungal infections that spread through the blood, which usually, again, you see in people that are immunocompromised or bacterial infections, the white blood cell counts go down or they're just not responding at all. People that are on chemotherapy is another situation where their white blood cell counts may go down because the white blood cells get destroyed by
right.
the medications. Yeah. So those are some of the areas that can affect white blood cell counts in people who are otherwise healthy. So if we make the assumption that a person is otherwise healthy, not on medications to reduce immune response, viral infections and bacterial infections will result, systemic infections will result in elevated white blood cell counts as a means of the body protecting itself. In terms of other tests, other than white blood cell counts or what the writer asks about what's called sedimentation rates. The sedimentation rate is also known as an ESR, which is called erythrocyte sedimentation rates. And all this is a measure of generalized inflammatory responses in the body, but is very nonspecific. You can't make diagnoses with it. other than saying something is going on. But there are other markers, usually other white blood cell markers, other compounds that can be released in the bloodstream in response to inflammation, but they're generally not done because for the most part, for most people, the white blood cell count is a pretty good indicator of infection.
Oh. So generally, so the answer to his question is?
Is in general, for otherwise healthy people that are not immunocompromised, not taking any medications, if you have an infection, especially bacterial or viral, white blood cell counts will be elevated. Bacterial infections tend to cause much greater levels of white blood cells than viral infections, but nevertheless, and different types of white blood cells respond. You'll see different subsets of white blood cells if it's bacterial versus viral.
But the answer to the question, would there be other tests or other infections that do not show up as white?
Not usually. Again, it's not the infections that's the issue. It's the state of the person's body in response to that infection.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So in our break between, you correctly pointed out that the pronunciation is C. difficile.
Right.
So thank you very much for that. what is it, and how come the hospital seems to be a breeding ground for it?
Well, it's not necessarily that the hospital is a breeding ground. It's that the hospital has sick people in it and older people in it. In fact, one of the Clostridium difficile is a bacteria that is very resistant in, I should step back a bit.
No, you'll be following the mic. Don't.
It has two physical states. There's a state outside of the body and a state inside. Outside of the body, it's a spore. And as a spore, it's resistant. And now here you'll see why it's so difficult in hospitals. As a spore, it's resistant to heat, acid, and antibiotics. So you can see it's really designed to survive very hostile conditions as a spore. When it is transferred, person swallows it, goes into their intestine.
How does it happen?
Hand contact.
Really?
If spores on your hand, you go to the patient, you touch, or if family members come in, they touch the patient, hand comes to the mouth, they swallow,
but
goes down to the gut.
Where does it come from? In other words, do we all have it?
People will harbor some of this bacteria, but for the most part, it's not dangerous because it's kept in check by other bacterial colonies in your intestine.
So low resistance would make you vulnerable?
So people that are on antibiotics, for example, where the bacteria, the normal bacterial colonies in their intestine get destroyed,
right?
The C. difficile moves in and takes over.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that you see. And in fact, some of the treatments now for it, because it can be very difficult to treat, you have to use very powerful antibiotics to treat it, which takes a toll on the person to begin with.
Yeah, well, that's funny that it's antibiotic problem that causes.
Yeah, and then yeah,
and then you're treating
but
it. Yeah.
But one of the approaches now, and as unappetizing as this sounds, one of the approaches which seems to work quite well is called a fecal transplant. And as the name implies,
I've heard this.
Yes,
yeah.
As the name implies, again, the reason the C. difficile is having a field day in your intestine is that the normal bacteria that should be there are not there.
Right.
And so what this entails is you're literally taking colon bacteria, you're getting rid of all the waste, you're just simply harvesting the bacteria, you eliminate any possibility for infection in terms of transferring anything, and by an enema, you give this bacteria back into the large intestine, and those bacteria recolonize the gut and kill off the C. difficile. And it works.
Really?
It does work.
Is it painful?
It's not painful.
No?
No, it's not painful.
Not anesthetic or what?
Depends on...
It's a reverse enema.
It's a reverse enema.
Right.
That's pretty much what it is.
There's got to be a word for... is there a word for reverse enema?
No.
It's just...
You can just call it a transplantation. How's that?
Repopulation.
There are certain hospitals that are doing that. You need to have the facilities to have the purified bacteria to use. But when you think about the underlying mechanism of disease being the loss of that bacteria that protect you, it stands to reason that replacing that bacteria would be very effective. for the same reason that, you know, if you're just giving an antibiotic to kill the C. difficile, but you don't have your colon bacteria to grow back, it makes it very difficult to eliminate
do
it.
Do all hospitals do this now?
No, there's not very many hospitals. There's in the U.S. they do it. I think in Toronto there's a clinic
that does this. Is this a controversial approach?
Not really.
It's like conventional medicine?
It's not unconventional because you are applying the understanding of what causes the disease process in the first place, right? If you know that using an antibiotic increases the risk of this infection, especially in the elderly, then it stands to reason that replacing the bacteria that you destroyed will help prevent that infection.
Acidophilus, mm-hmm. would that help?
To a certain extent, using Acidophilus might. If we're talking about probiotic use, it might, but you have to have the right bacterium. You're trying to reestablish normal colonies again in the gut. And selectively choosing one or two bacterial species is not necessarily going to do that, which is why you're trying to harvest the whole gamut of bacteria that's found in the gut and transplanting it back in.
So taking it from the patient's own excess is sort of like a no-brainer that it's going to work.
It's nothing is guaranteed, but in the clinical studies that have been done to do this, is the evidence is such that it is working quite well. In fact, I'm looking this up for you right now, and it says here, the exact complement of fecal bacteria that are required to restore a normal fecal microbiota is unclear, so they still are trying to figure out exactly how much. But they do recommend treatment at a center of expertise. And the evidence for doing this, and this is what's important when you're looking at evidence, it is a strong recommendation to do so, and it's based on randomized controlled trials. So there is good scientific evidence to show that this is...
And it's a heck of a lot better than another round of heavy antibiotics.
That's right, a lot less expensive, a lot less harmful to the patient.
Oh, for sure.
And... It says here too, it appears to be safe. Risks include those associated with the use of nasogastric tubes and with colonoscopy. So same kind of risks when you do it that way. Another concern is the potential of transmission of infectious agents contained in the stool. This risk may be reduced by obtaining stool from healthy donors with normal bowel function and by testing both stool and blood for common viral and bacterial pathogens and parasites, which is what we talked about. You just make sure.
There
but
you go.
The evidence is there to use it. It's just a matter of having a center of excellence to do it.
Got it. So when we come back, we have Pasha and Shyam. I hope I pronounced the name correctly. And interesting questions about repairing cartilage and fish oil. 613-521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 800-580-2372, and rbulka@cfra.com. If you can do that all in 15 seconds, you're good. We're right back.
Now back to Sunday Night with Rabbi Bolka on News Talk Radio 580 CFRA.
Okay, 613-521-8255, *580, Bell Mobility free call, 800-580-2372, toll free, rbulka@cfra.com. This is your last opportunity because this is our last segment. Phyllis Diller, she said something quite interesting about mothers that I share with you, which I found it very, shall we say, funny. I want my children to have all the things I couldn't afford. Then I want to move in with them. Okay, we have Pasha. How are you, Pasha?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you, Rabbi?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice. What's doing?
Yeah, I have a question for the good doctor.
Sure.
My question is, I'm sure when you have a knee joint replacement due to loss of cartilage, then you replace the entire knee joint with an artificial joint made of titanium and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the same procedure when you have loss of cartilage for a shoulder joint?
Yeah, they do have artificial joints for the shoulder, the same way they do for hips. It's a little bit more specialized to replace a shoulder. They're not done as often as knees, but nevertheless, knees or hips. But nevertheless, there certainly is the titanium hardware that is used to help replace shoulder joints if they are severely degraded.
Is that a much more difficult and complicated operation than the knee or the hip that you mentioned?
Yeah, it can be a little bit more complicated, and the reason is that just in the armpit area, you have what's known as the brachial plexus. The brachial plexus is a series of nerves that originate from the neck, and it comes down into the arm that supplies all the innervation and sensory and motor functions for the arm. And so you have to be very careful when operating on a shoulder that you're not going to clip or damage those nerves. So that it makes it a little bit more complicated to do, unlike the knee, where there's very little in terms of there are some nerves that run down the leg, but they can be very easily isolated because they're literally nerve trunks, like a cable.
Mm-hmm.
The brachial plexus is, as the name implies, a plexus is interconnected nerves. It's not just one nerve. It's a whole series of nerves that are interconnected. And so it's not just a single cable you can move out of the way. You have to literally isolate and find each one of those nerves in the tissue and keep them away from the area where you're replacing the shoulder joint. So it can be done, and it is done successfully, but it is more complicated because of the anatomy in that area.
Is it a very risky operation?
That I can't comment on, because I don't have many patients that have had it done. In terms of risk, there's always risks to surgery.
You've done the knee.
But I've done the knee, but not the shoulder. So I don't know what the risk is in terms of damage to the nerves. And that would be more along the lines of the orthopedic surgeon that would be able to provide that kind of information.
Yeah. I know what I remember when I had my broken arm,
mm-hmm.
and I spoke with the surgeon, and he said to me, after he finished with me, it turns out there would be a 1 in 10 chance that there would be complications in this, which would either make things worse or get me back to the mm-hmm. operating table.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's exactly with the exact same thing as you, Pasha, but it was.
I have a close relative who's been diagnosed more than 10 years ago. He was referred to a sports medicine doctor who said that he has absolutely no cartilage in his shoulder mm-hmm. joint. But then this gentleman pulled on and on for the past 10 or more years, but now he's having lots of trouble. So since he's pulled on for 10 years and he's about 70 years old or so, is it worthwhile for him to go to see an orthopedic specialist to do this particular kind of operation that you just described?
It usually is a good idea to get an opinion from the surgeon if surgery is a reasonable solution. Age is not a restriction to surgery. It's more whether the person has specific medical conditions that would make the surgery more complicated or put them at risk for other, put their other illnesses at risk or put the recovery time at risk.
Pasha, thank you very, very much. Good luck to your friend.
Thank you
very
much for the elucidation, Dr. Andrew.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Pasha.
Bye.
Good. We have Shyam in Ottawa.
Thank you, Robert.
Heller, before you go, you can't get in so fast. You have to explain your name.
Oh, Shyam.
What does it mean?
Shyam means the Sham. It's in Indian. It's the toilet. When the sun is dipping and the darkness comes, the kissing of the light and darkness.
Oh.
Shyam.
Ah, very nice.
Right, okay,
good. Okay, so you're entitled to a question now that you gave us this.
Thank you. I want to just pinch the valuable time of the dear doctor there. I'm a heart patient.
Yes.
And I had a heart attack when I was 59. Now I'm 80.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening? So I've got away from medication. I went to a lot of the supplements. Recently, there has been a lot of controversy with the fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, I'd like to get your opinion. They are saying that long-term use of fish oil can cause hardening of the arteries.
There's no evidence that that's going to harden the arteries, especially uh-huh. if you're using omega-3 fatty acids.
Okay.
However, the evidence with regards to heart disease prevention mm-hmm. and the use of omega fatty acids or fish oils isn't that great. There really isn't much to suggest, and this is coming from a really good website. It's called consumerlab.com,
okay.
and it is an independent site that looks at all the scientific evidence and just presents a very dispassionate overview of each compound. So there's no bias in terms of one way or the other. They're not promoting anything. And in this case, there really isn't much with regards to some of the larger studies that were done with regards to heart disease prevention. There really isn't much to say that that particular compound itself contributes to it. And I think where the fish oil controversy comes from is that we tend to like to isolate specific things and say A leads to B, or taking fish oils will do this for you, as opposed to saying, okay, what is it in the overall diet in people that eat lots of fish? What else are they eating? What else are they doing? And when you look at, for example, Mediterranean diets or other diets where people are not eating processed foods, they're eating lots of fruits and vegetables, they're eating fish, there's not much dairy, there's not much red meat, there may be some chicken. And you'll see that people's health and heart health tends to be better. And I think it's because of everything that they're doing. You know, if they're exercising, they're not smoking, their weight is nice and stable, their blood pressure is nice and stable. All those things contribute to overall heart health, as opposed to saying that it's the omega fatty acids or the fish oils themselves that are contributing to it. They might certainly contribute in concert with everything else, but to isolate it and say that this is the only thing that contributes to better heart health, I think misleads people and makes them spend lots of money that they shouldn't be spending.
Okay. Well, thank you so kindly for your
time. Thank you, Shyam. Thanks for your lesson in the name meaning.
Thank you.
Very good. So we have a few seconds left. Wanted to check out with you on autism.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Is there anything about our society? Is this something that we always had? Is this something new?
I think the people are much more sensitive to the diagnosis and that there's more vigilance. But I don't think it's necessarily, there's certainly no proof to say that our society itself is somehow contributing to increased autism rates. They may find something. They may find that there could be something within our environment potentially. But, you know, it could be, you know, is it because we're having children at a later age as opposed to an earlier age? But there's no specific, there's no specific etiology or cause that we can isolate right now. And that's what makes it so frustrating for a lot of people, because they want answers as to why it's happening, you know, what caused it. And right now, when you can't give an answer to the absolute cause, you have a lot of hypotheses that come out. You know, you have the vaccine hoax that came out that said vaccines caused autism.
Yeah, there's no evidence that it's genetic, is there?
There's no evidence right now to say that there's a genetic thing. There might be. They're looking for genetic predispositions. Right. But again, even if it was genetic, you have to keep in mind that just because you may have a genetic potential for a disease doesn't mean you'll have that disease.
Correct.
There are other factors that flip the switches that turn the genes on that could lead to that. So that leads you to ask, okay, is there something that the mother may be exposed to in utero when that could contribute to the flipping of those genetic switches? And I think that's where they're looking for causes, to see if there's something that leads to that kind of change. But again, it's a very, unfortunately, because there was so much energy focused on the MMR vaccine and refuting and debunking that whole fiasco, that so much money was spent in the wrong area, that you now are playing catch up with looking at the areas that we should have looked at in the first place.
So when are you writing your first book, Ask the Doctor?
I'm not writing any book.
You're not writing any book?
No book.
Why not?
It's
I think anybody's on radio so often like you and has answered so many questions, I think it would almost be criminal not to write a book.
Well, but the thing is that there are so many medical books out there that already provide that information.
That is a bunk excuse. Anyway, yeah. It's always a pleasure having you.
Likewise.
And
you're
okay if we end with a Mother's Day quote?
I'll go right ahead.
Yeah, we got Dorothy Canfield Fisher saying, "A mother is not a person to lean on, but a person to make leaning unnecessary."
Very good.
Okay. So happy Mother's Day, everyone out there. It's thanks to you mothers that Dr. Barry is in business. Have a wonderful week.